I can also make fun of Russians.
Gotcha. No, I don't have any Russian in me, but I got Slovakian in me, so.
Well, Ukrainian, the original Russians, the Kievan Rus. Oh, all right. The original Russians, not the Moscovites who stole the fucking name.
Yeah, gotcha, gotcha. All right. So, sorry, I was looking to see if that was a former student. I don't think that's him. All right. So we get a situation brewing where America is coming into the war. America was largely a neutral country throughout its history, and Americans embraced that concept of neutrality. But like anyone, if you keep pushing, you keep pushing, and you keep pushing, eventually it's going to trigger a reaction. And those four events that seemed to occur back to back to back to back, ultimately what pushed the President of the United States, who ironically got reelected only because he pledged neutrality, to decide to make the move and go to war. And because of pre-planning that was going in 1916, which I alluded to, the nation was able to respond relatively quickly with a draft. They put their finances in order, and of course they would seize control over the economy to take it from a peacetime focus to a war effort. But let's not say that this was universally embraced in these United States of America. Now, unfortunately, we do not know what percentage of people were against it because they didn't take opinion polls back then. But there is ample evidence to suggest that there was a lot. Not only elected leaders, but also among the general population. For instance, on the floors of the Senate, Nebraska Senator George Norris proclaimed the reason why the United States is going to war was, and I quote, "We are going into war at command of gold. We're doing it for the money." Socialist leader Eugene Debs said that the war was, and I quote, "The master class has always been declared wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. The master class has had all to gain and nothing to lose, while the subject class has nothing to gain and all to lose, including their lives." Evidence of the strong anti-war sentiment appeared with the emergence of a viable American Socialist Party that began winning in all of the major cities in the United States. And in some communities, socialists won between 30 and 40% of the vote. Not that the people were necessarily socialists, but it was only the socialists that were talking against the war. Whereas the Republicrats, the Demokins, whatever you want to use, the Uniparty, seem to not necessarily reflect the will of the people. Surprise, surprise, surprise. So, the government knew they had to do something about it, and they did. In March 19... Not March, sorry, hold on. April was declared 2 weeks later. So, the end of April 1917... Congress would establish what became known as the Committee on Public Information. And the purpose of the Committee of Public Information was to use their words, to mobilize the thinking of the American people. In other words, their intentions was to make the dissenters shut their mouths. In charge of this committee was George Creel, who, ironically, was a prominent muckraker. If you don't know what a muttraker was, during the beginning, do you know what it is?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
It's basically, it was a reporter that, they kind of came to problems after the Slaughterhouse 5. They published a story just, like, exposing the meat slaughter industry for how just disgusting it was and how, yep, like, they would let, like, everything slide. Putting, like, rats in, like, meat grinding and, like, human bones and meat.
Right. So yeah, muttraker is a reporter, isn't it? It was sensationalized reporting.
Yeah.
Aimed at not facts, but stirring the emotions. It's the kind of stuff that the media does today, the cable news. They don't tell you the truth. They say things to whip up the people who are inclined to support their individual agendas. So if you are conservative leading, you know, Fox is going to speak to you. They're not necessarily going to tell you the whole truth and nothing but the truth. They're going to tell you subjective truth. Just like MSNBC. No one tells us the truth. But rather, they want the group think, because they'll force you to tune in, and as you tune in, the channels make their money through their advertisers.
It's a whole money game. The government doesn't want you to be informed.
No, not at all.
They want you to be a slave to the system.
Yep. Yep. Well, this committee was going to put an end to it. Free thinking. They were going to, in fact, make you a slave to the system by make you think correctly. So what did they do? They moved against thought. Libraries began removing troublesome books. And across the country, there were many public book burnings. Schools removed German from the curriculum. Like if you were in public school, you didn't learn Spanish. You didn't learn French, you probably learned German. Well, that was gone. Anything German would be removed. For instance, what at the time were known as Frankfurters became renamed as hot dogs. Sauerkraut became Liberty Cabbage. And heck, they took Datsuns and called them Liberty Pops. By the way, another part of this was the push for the 18th Amendment. What did the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution do?
Wasn't that prohibition?
That was prohibition. Who was making all the beer that Americans loved?
The Germans.
The Germans were. So, there were campaigns that basically said, if you drank Anheuser-Busch, Schlitz, Schaefer, you're anti-American. Now, as bad as all that was, Congress got into the action, which made it even worse, by passing laws aimed at, for the first time in U.S. history, actually reining in the basic freedoms, which today we've lost. And you don't even realize it. And chances are you probably don't even care. Acts such as having the ability to use literally the First Amendment to the Constitution. Freedom of speech. Freedom of press. Freedom of association. Freedom to grieve and peaceably assemble. In June 1917, Congress passed the Conscription Act, which I talked about, which was the draft. But contained within the legislation were specific clauses that went against draft dodgers. If you were drafted and you refused to enlist and wear the uniform of this country to take up arms or to perform certain duties, so like if you were handicapped and you were drafted, that still put you to work, you would be court-martialed. You wouldn't go into a civilian courthouse, no. You would be brought before a military court tribunal. And if you were convicted, you would receive a minimum sentence of 20 years in Fort Leavenworth. Maximum, death penalty. FYI, from 1917 until the end of the war in 1918, 504 men were convicted. About 4,000 were brought up on trial, but 504 were convicted. 17 of them were given the death penalty. Death by hanging. 142 were given life sentences, and 345 were given more than 20 years. Now, FYI, after the war ended and the next presidential election occurred, almost all of them had their sentences commuted. So it was Wilson's government that did it. Same month, same year, June 1917, Congress passed the Espionage Act. While the rates are much higher now, because this law is still in effect, and they tried getting Trump under this, involved in this law, which makes it a crime for anyone who presents false reports to the government or tries to interfere with military operations or is suspected of promoting the success of the enemies, or interfere with the draft in any way. If you are convicted, essentially of being found guilty of disloyalty, you would receive a $10,000 fine in 1917 money. FYI, the average annual income from someone in 1917 was give or take about $60 a year. So they're getting a $10,000 fine. And minimum 20 years prison. So, if the government thinks you're disloyal. Oh, and if you say anything against the government, they'll get you too. This was passed in May 1918, the Sedition Act. You know what sedition is, right?
Treason.
Basically, it's treason. It's you are claiming things against your government that could be deemed as basically treasonous. Well, under this law, if you, and again, keep in mind, we're in a nation that literally the First Amendment to our Constitution gives us freedom of speech, freedom of the press. Well, if you are found guilty, and I quote, of willfully or utterly printing, writing, or publishing any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the United States government, its elected officials, the Constitution, the flag, or the armed services, $10,000 fine, minimum 20 years in prison. So if you say the President of the United States is a buffoon, that's potentially a crime. This also applied to anyone who obstructed the sale of Liberty Bonds, anyone who engaged in protests outside of recruitment offices, or attempted to produce anything that could impact the fighting of the war. FYI, about 6,000 people were charged under the Espionage Act. 1,500 persons, give or take, were imprisoned. The most famous of which was Eugene Debs. I think I got a picture right there. Eugene Debs, leader of the American Socialist Party. Now, ironically, Eugene Debs was so angry over his arrest in the presidential election of 1920, he actually ran for the presidency while in prison. Didn't win, but he tried. Now, by the way, Wilson, refused to pardon him, even after the war was over. Again, that would happen during the next administration. And there were other things. Not that you have to remember any of these. These are just things that I found in my my research. Newspapers. Newspapers, again, First Amendment. It gives you the right to freely express your religion. It prevents the United States government from creating a national church. Then there's free speech. And then the next clause, the fourth clause in, is freedom of the press. Newspapers caught printing anything dubbed to be anti-press would lose their mailing privileges. The United States Postal Office would seize the papers. Judges tended to put maximum sentences on people who criticized the war. Patriotic mobs took to the streets and actually physically attacked anti-war protesters. But one of the most famous incidents of them all was when a socialist by the name of Victor Berger, who was actually elected to go to Congress by Wisconsin, was not seated by the House of Representatives. They didn't let him come in. So the people elected him twice, and he was not allowed to come in and take the oath and serve the people that elected him. Why? Well, it was claimed that he was convicted under the Espionage Act. But here's the thing. He did go to court, but the government had no evidence to prove its claims. So he was convicted, but not found guilty. And by the way, we have that in our country today, where people are damned if they're convicted of a crime, even though there may not be any proof. Yes, yeah, that's the standard in today's, depending on who you are. Because then there are other people that are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but it doesn't matter.
This is so tyrannical, it's actually starting to piss me off a little bit.
Well,
just a little bit.
Well, I'm almost done with America, so. Actually, I am done with America for now, so. So
that's wild. I didn't know that.
Now, what's the point? Well, very simple. Don't read all the, believe all the propaganda. Again, not that I'm socialist in any way, but my attitude, I'm a libertarian. My attitude has always been the same thing. You have a right to think and say whatever you want. The government should not get involved. Because remember what they did to us during COVID?
Oh yeah, likewise. Yeah,
Charlie Baker's lockdown came during the Spanish flu. That's where the precedent came from. Our governor looked at something that happened during the war. All right, let's go on to a lighter topic. Not really. Let's go from America back to the Eastern Front. Well, just as America came in, the Allies were doing bad everywhere. All of the war was moving in the direction of the Central Powers. But out of all of the theaters of war, hands down, what was going on in the Eastern Front was the worst. Because look at where the border was at the beginning of the war, right? And look at where the border was by the time of December 1917. And each one of these are German forces. And they're going further inland. Russia lacks the ability to defend its frontier. It is losing. But Germany could not score a slam dunk because of the scope. Unlike the Western Front, the Russian front was over 1,000 miles, filled with mostly vast acres of farmlands, very few cities, very few roads, very few railroads. We talked about all that already. So because of what was going on, 1916 in Verdun and elsewhere, Germany had to concentrate most of its strength on the west, so it couldn't send enough to win fully in the east. blah, 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 da, da. Now, why? Well, if you recall, way back when we started talking about the second exam stuff, I think we covered the fact that Russia should have never joined the war because they weren't ready for the war. Yes, they had the largest army, standing army in the world at the time, 1.4 million men. Covered that. We also covered that they were able to mobilize 5 million more men, bringing their steamroller up to 6.5 million men in the first month alone. But we also covered that they didn't have enough rifles for these guys. About an eighth of their men literally went into battle with no guns. They had spears, they had pitchforks, but no rifles. Oh, another note that I have in here that I have written handwriting. Don't forget, I also mentioned the fact that their soldiers that went in with rifles, they had 20 different types. So you might have had a gun, but chances are you probably didn't have any ammo for it anyways. So you had to wait for your buddy to die so you could take the couple of rounds that he may have, so you could fight. Plus, as we've seen examples, we've only covered a couple of Russian generals, but let's just say I don't think any of them that we touched upon were spectacular. There was a lot of nepotism going on. There was problems. And at the top of the mountain was the Tsar. When the war started, the Tsar, being the Tsar, declared himself to be commander-in-chief. He had no actual military experience. And all of his generals were nobles. And while some did have military experience, none of them were trained in military academies. They didn't know tactics. And they didn't care. And to make matters worse, they didn't care about their men. Again, the Germans on one side. I could not imagine being an officer telling my soldiers, just go charge at them. And when you die, we'll send more, and we'll send more. Eventually, they'll run out of bullets. But as we know, ultimately, that was the Russian strategy. And of course, the moment one had a setback, they were removed and replaced. So you didn't have that continuity, unlike what was in Germany. And as if that was not bad enough, they had limited medical staff. The best number that I got, and I don't know how accurate it was, because I don't necessarily know if I trust the source, but I read in one book, you had one surgeon for every 10,000 wounded men. So odds are, if you are wounded, you're probably going to get an infection, and you're probably going to die, because you're not going to be able to see a surgeon. Or you're going to have happen, I don't think you can see it, no, I don't have the picture, I thought I did. Well, these would be military hospitals, you know, just jammed with guys. But what they ended up having to do is they had to resort to tactics that were used in the U.S. Civil War. If a guy basically had a bullet wound on a limb, out comes the saw. Yeah. Well, have a couple of cupfuls of vodka. You'll be fine.
Nah, I like having my arm.
We also know, we covered this, that there was little, if any, strategy. It was just throw men at it. We saw it at some of the sieges that we talked about. They didn't use massive artillery bombardments because they didn't have artillery shells. So you'd send a couple of rounds and then you just charge the guys. And then the next day, send a couple more rounds, charge the guns. Well, I'm sure all of us can imagine, for the Russian guy at the back of the line and seeing what's going on, I'm sure when it was his time up, he's just sitting back saying, all I want to do is get home and see my mom. So as a result, two things occurred all across the Eastern Front. The Germans slaughtered the Russians. And morale and the Russian forces completely collapsed. The campaigns that we talked about for 1916, in total, I think I mentioned it, I'll reiterate it, just in 1916 alone, over 2 million casualties, plus another 500,000 prisoners of war. Russians basically said, I'd rather be a POW than die. As if all of that was not bad enough, I got one more for you. The Catch-22. Unlike all of the other combatants that had the ability to take a portion of their fighting age men and put them in the war, but still managed to maintain some type of production in Russia, the vast majority of the population were peasants involved in food production. So if you have a factory, you have the ability to take the man out at the very least, and you could put a woman in, and the factories can continue to run. Think of Rosie the Riveter. Think of what happened during World War II. Well, in Russia, if 90% of your population is making food, and the most effective workers in that labor-intensive environment are the men, what's going to happen to food production as you start losing millions of them?
It's going to go down, and people are going to starve.
Yeah. So food production plummets, prices skyrocket, and you have problems at home. Because the few places that had factories, the cities, don't make food. So the food stops coming in. You have less production in the countryside. You have nothing getting into the cities. And you have chaos across the land. And ultimately, oh, there's the death toll. All right. I didn't know that was coming up as a thing. And ultimately, here we go, it would trigger a revolution. In the midst of a war, a revolution would break out in Russia. Questions? All right. The Russian Revolution of 1917. Now, ironically, you may or may not know, there actually was not a revolution, but there were actually a couple that kind of fell back to back to back. What triggered these was the social dynamic in the country. There were many leading experts on Russia throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries that made analogies of that Russia essentially was a volcano. That like a volcano, there's tremendous pressure underground, and eventually the pressure is going to build up so much, it's just going to explode. As we know, it was the social dynamic that was the cause. Russia was the largest land-based empire on Earth. But the size came at a price. The ruling ethnicity, the Muscovite Rus, only represented about 45% of the empire's population. Because as the Russian Empire grew from its European foundations and expanded across the vast North Asian continent, they conquered ethnic group after ethnic group after ethnic group. So, when the war started, there were over 20 languages that were spoken. There were 16 religions that were practiced. And, regardless of the differences, almost everybody was poor. Which, when you have a nation of poor people, there's problems. Oh, and there was no chance of economic opportunity. You know, one of the greatest things about America is you could be born dirt poor. But all it takes is you to get off your ass and work. And you can make, you're probably not going to become rich, but you can be quite comfortable. So I was probably one of the poorest people in my graduating high school class. Single mother, had some government subsidies, but at one point she got a job and she was making too much to get the government handouts, but not enough really to do anything. I had to wear hand-me-downs, like my cousin's like shirts. Some of them had like their last names on it. That was fun going to school. Who's this Jones? You're not Jones, you're Lamanic.
That's my cousin's shirt.
And by the way, back when I was a kid, ripped jeans was not cool whatsoever. But my mother couldn't even afford to buy me new pants. So I went to school with holes all in them. Not trying to be style. It was just I was poor. But you know what I decided? I don't like being poor. So I started working when I was 10 years old. Had a paper out. Saved, scrimped. Paid my way through college. Bought my own car. And continue to work hard. Now, 40 years later, I'm in my 50s, and I financially could retire right now. Not rich. Have a house paid for. Have cars paid for. Kids are in college. Got a big nest egg because I put every single penny I could in the bank. Because I did not like being poor. And by the way, not special. Not special. Had a lot of bumps along the way. A couple of points where I had no money. I just didn't want to be poor, so I didn't let myself be poor. Well, in Russia, you had no chance. There was no opportunity. Like, there was one point I worked 3 jobs. I was working 20 hours a day. Did not want to be poor. What?
20 hours?
Yeah, long days. I was working full-time while going to college full-time, too. I didn't sit around in my dorms playing video games or watching TikTok. I went to class. Then I went to work. I made my schedules. So I went to work class Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I worked those 20-hour shifts on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. Granted, my schedule rotated, but did whatever I could to make sure there's money in my bank account. I got out of school owing nothing because I paid cash for everything. Why? Because you live in America. You can make as much money as you actually want to. You just got to do it. Russia, nothing. You were born a peasant, you die a peasant. There were no jobs, there was no money.
Well, they also looked down on serfs. They considered serfs like a slave.
Oh, yeah. Serfdom, I think, was abolished during the reign of Tsar Alexander II, but you're only talking 2 generations removed. But the mindset was still there.
Yeah, that's because the Tsar technically owned all the land, and he rented it out to, I forget their titles, but like the...
Yeah, whatever the nobility was, yeah.
And the peasants had to pay rent to them.
Yeah.
When he got rid of that whole system, he did it because he wanted to boost the production of factories, wasn't it? Because they didn't want to move off the land, because it's like, why would I live in a city if I can live on a farm?
Yeah, exactly. Because at that point, we had nothing, and now suddenly we have an opportunity to make something, so we're just going to stay and not take the risk. Yeah, 100%. That happened after the revolution, 1905.
Didn't they also try like really hard to get people out of the farms and like into like the cities for battle?
Yeah. They tried
like really, really hard. Like even like capitals from other countries came in and like.
Yeah, but it's like if you have like 7 or 8, if you're like 20 generations of a farmer and all you know is like the farm, like why do you want to leave at that point?
Right, because guess what you're gonna get when your parents die?
The farm.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 100%. You also had no rights in any way, shape, or form. The Tsar's government was maintained through a police state. And of course, the police officers were the soldiers. There was no due process. There was no habeas corpus. If a soldier arrived on the scene and suspected you of engaging any type of illegality, he would suffer no consequences if you ended up with a bullet in your head. Now, as we've been alluding to, there was warning signs. And that was the 1905 revolution. Commonly referred to as Bloody Sunday. Because guess when it took place?
It took place on Sunday.
It did. And guess what happened to the people who were protesting?
They got machine gunned down.
They got bloodied. Yeah, they got bloodied. Now, this movement was actually not an organized rebellion. There was no clear leadership. And, sadly, it began when a bunch of people who were hungry and starving went to the Tsar's palace in St. Petersburg to beg for a day off. Because they weren't getting paid, the people living in the city, St. Petersburg, they weren't getting paid squat, and they needed to take a day off. Because they wanted to be able to not only go to church, which was obligated, but in Russia you went to church and then you went back to work. Well, they wanted to go to church and then spend at least a day with their family. They did not have weapons. They actually went outside the walls and they started praying. Well, the problem was, is the Tsar was not at home. He was out on a hunting expedition. The commander of the palace guards, however, was obligated to protect the Tsarina and the Tsar's children. So, because there was no consequences, instead of talking to them and basically saying, hey, look, guys, sorry, the Tsar's not there, they simply opened fire. This triggered revolts throughout the city. But here's the thing. The revolts were quickly crushed because the army remained loyal to the Tsar. Now, the Tsar should have made meaningful reforms. He did create the Duma, which supposedly was a legislative body, but the Tsar still had complete dictatorial authority. And he did do tricky things. Like remove some of the traditional feudal labels and use phrases like citizens and comrades, but the people didn't really have any new rights. They just changed the name of things. So, he had a chance and he missed it. Plus, in part, you can't necessarily blame the Tsar. Because the Tsar believed he literally was in a struggle for survival, because on an international stage, as we saw, Russia suffered humiliation after humiliation after humiliation. Remember all those things we talked about? Being outmaneuvered by Austria, being blocked by Britain and France, being beaten by the Japanese. At every turn, the weakness of the regime was exposed, so the Tsar was terrified that at one point the people would rise up and overthrow the regime. And they had every reason to. 3% of the Russian population controlled 98% of the wealth. When I said before, the poor had no chance. They had no chance. I wish I could remember the Russian class name for the nobility. But they basically had all the wealth and they had all the power. They had all the opportunities. They lived in luxury. And then there was everybody else. And that's one of the reasons why Russia was not prepared for the war. If you're going to go fight, you got to be able to put guns in the hands of your soldiers. And you got to be able to provide them bullets. And they didn't have that. You got to be able to prepare, have the men have adequate medical care. Not present. The men got to have adequate clothing. Because Russia's fucking cold. So they need jackets. They need warm sleeping bags, tents. Then have it. And you need food. Well, if the farm boy gets taken off the farm and goes fights on the front, who's at the farm making food? Not smart. But again, hindsight's 20/20. As I said, the Tsar only got into it because he believed it would be a quick war. Because everyone did. So while all this was going on, when the warning signs were there, those that were in the power to do something were completely oblivious. A year before the revolution, by mid-1916, particularly after the Brezhnev affront completely collapsed, it was clear. And again, I have to rely upon translated sources, but there were more letters that were going home from the front. Soldiers basically saying, we're getting slaughtered. There were letters being sent from the home to the front in which families were telling their son, we have no money, we have no food. What was there was worthless. And the Tsar refused to do anything to boost morale. No national holidays, no parades, you know, no smoke and mirrors. Or bread and circus. To use a Roman expression. So all it would take is just a little push. The people were so angry about everything. Just a little push. And the push occurred on March 8th. Our calendar. FYI, Russia at this time was still using their calendar. So our calendar was March 8th. On the Russian calendar, it was February 23rd. On this day, the factory workers spontaneously walked out of the factories and went on strike. The workers had not been paid in weeks. And to make matters worse, the only food that came in was procured through bread lines. So, before the sun came up, the husband would go to work in the factory, and the wife would take the kids and go stand in line. If they did not get there early enough, when the food ran out, So you went hungry. And if you missed out on that day, well, guess what you did the next day? You tried getting up a little earlier. In hopes that maybe you would get the daily ration. All foodstuffs was rationed. No one could get any other basic commodities. So no clothes, nothing like that. You could get government handed out food. That's about it. Oh, and vodka. Vodka was cheap. Well, the workers were so pissed off that they hadn't been paid, and they were so pissed off that their wives hadn't been able to get food, the workers, the men decided, well, we're going to get the women out of the line, and we're going to get in line. Well, I don't know if when you were in elementary school there was ever a situation where someone gave one of their buddies cutsies, and then the next thing you know, push comes to shove, and there's a brawl breaking out. And that's pretty much how it began. Riots began erupting as people were fighting for food. Well, unlike 1905 when the soldiers shot the rioters, in 1917, the soldiers actually joined the riots. Because guess what these boys didn't want to have happen to them? They didn't want to go to the front. Things began spontaneously spiraling out of complete control. But because it was a dictatorship, the only person who could do anything about it was the Tsar. And this is an understatement. when the strike broke out, the Tsar was not even in the capital. He was on the front because he felt that he could boost the morale of the men by giving them a little face time. Now, truth be told, all of the soldiers that the Tsar met with were informed by their commanding officers, if you do anything that's disloyal, you will be shot as soon as the Tsar leaves. So the photo ops look great. Look at the men. They're standing proud. They're saluting. By the way, you also only made sure the soldiers that had the clean uniforms were allowed to get into formation as well. The generals didn't even tell the Tsar what was going on. So imagine his surprise 3 days later on February 26th on the Russian calendar, when a communication caught up to the Tsar from the chairman of the Duma, the head of the legislative branch, Mikhail Rodzinenko. The first communication said the following, and I quote, "The capital is in chaos. The government is unable to act. The transportation service is broken down. The food and fuel supplies are completely disorganized. There are wild shootings on the street. It is urgent that a new government is formed." In other words, that's the European style of election. So you kick out the political party and you put a new political party in. "There must no be delay. Hesitation is fatal." The Tsar reads this. He doesn't believe it. His people would never rebel against him. So instead of replying to Rodzinenko, the following day he sends word to his wife, the Tsarina, in which he stated again, and I quote, "that the fat-bellied Rodzinenko has written me a load of nonsense, which I won't even bother to answer." The following day, March 1st, on the Russian calendar, the Tsar receives another report from the palace guards, not telling him what's going on in St. Petersburg. No. Instead, it mentions that the children, including his son and heir, Alexei, have the measles. So he ignores the head of the legislative branch, but he gets on his train and he orders it to race back to the capital because his kids have the measles. Well, unfortunately, when the Tsar's train is rolling, everybody on the line knows the Tsar's train's coming. And a group of soldiers that were not allowed at the photo op basically change the lines, force the train down a dead end, board the train, captures the Tsar, and they threaten to shoot him on the spot. This was one of the last pictures taken of the Tsar. He was basically advised by his generals, "You should abdicate." So on March 2nd, he gave up the throne. Now, ironically, to preserve the dynasty, the Tsar suggested that he give the throne to his brother Michael, who was a little more popular amongst the people. But Michael said, "I don't want this job." So as a result, the dynasty, the Romanov dynasty, which had been ruling Russia for 300 years, ends just like that. Now, FYI, The soldiers would eventually take the Tsar back to St. Petersburg under guard, and they would put the Tsar under house arrest. Now, he would attempt to get out of Russia with his family. His wife, Alexandria, his daughters, Olga, Tatiana, Marina, and Anastasia, and of course, his son, Alexei. He tried contacting his cousin, George V. He wasn't going to contact Willie. When he attempted to contact George V, and he asked for asylum. Apparently, the leaders of the Duma basically said, look, if we can find a place for you to go, we'll get you out. Well, ironically, in England, there was a socialist movement brewing in London. So George was afraid if he brought the Tsar out and brought him to England, that that would instigate the socialist more, and it could potentially result in a revolution in England. So when that didn't work, the Tsar tried contacting France, his oldest ally. And the French were like, ah, dude, we're in the middle of a war for our survival. We're on the verge of losing. Our army's in mutiny. I don't think it would be a good look. Even Woodrow Wilson, because the United States was still neutral, said plainly, no. So unfortunately, the Tsar, his wife, his beautiful daughters, and his son were trapped. Now, with the abdication, two centers of power would emerge to try to fill the vacuum. On one hand, you had what were known as Soviets. Soviets were councils made up of soldiers and workers. Out of all of the Soviets that would form throughout Russia, the one in the capital, Petrograd, obviously was the strongest. Controlling the Soviet were socialists. But they were Mensheviks. Not that you need to remember this detail for the exam, but I might as well explain what the hell I'm talking about. Back in 1906, 1907, the socialists, communists, held a congress. And they were talking about how are they going to move towards bringing communism to Russia. There was a group, I guess we could call them moderates, who basically said, well, the Duma's there, so maybe we should run candidates for elections, win power, and making socialist laws through the legislative process. The problem is Menshevik is Russian for minority. The majority, the Bolsheviks, wanted a full-blown Marxist revolution. But the Bolsheviks were scattered by the police state. The Mensheviks, because they were not for violence, death, and assassination, were pretty much allowed to be in place. So when this group formed, they got in and they took control. And they started talking about healthcare, wages, housing, all of the socialist stuff. Well, unfortunately, when you get a little socialism, it doesn't take much to become radicals. One of the three men that would experience that transformation, one of the three leaders, was a man by the name of Leon Trotsky. Now, at the same time, the remnants of the Duma would attempt to try to take control. They promised the creation of a republic. They promised a constitution. They promised checks and balances. They promised elections. But, as they stated, they needed time to be able to put all this stuff in place. Most of the members, however, were amongst what we would call the bourgeoisie, the elites of society. So yes, there were nobles, but you're also talking the one percenters as well. Of course, the irony is that all of these guys were elected into office, but less than 10% of the Russian population could vote. So while they claimed they were representatives of the people, they really weren't. The leader that would emerge of this group was, ironically, a former Menshevik by the name of Alexander Kerensky. He was kind of kicked out of the Mensheviks because, well, some of them started getting a little radical, he stayed moderate. And he thought that the mantra of democracy was the way to win. During the short term control by the provisional government, he originally was the Minister of Justice, then he would be made the Minister of War, but then he would finish his tenure out as Prime Minister. So you have the workers and the soldiers on one hand, and you have these bourgeoisie on the other. Needless to say, both sides were looking for legitimacy. So in a political game, how do you get the support of the people? How do politicians in our country win elections?
Lobbying.
Yeah, they make promises. If you vote for me, I'll do this. If you vote for me, I'll do that. So at the same time, the Soviets and the provisional government are trying to make promises to the people in order for the people to support them. And in doing so, they were caught in a conundrum. Because the one thing that the provisional government should have done, but chose not to, was they ended the police state. So they gave the people freedom. True story. Never going to happen here because this campus is way too small. But I went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst as an undergrad. And I lived in the part of campus called Southwest. If you ever visited UMass, that's the portion of campus that has the towers in it. And in fact, I lived in one of the towers. I lived in John Adams. Well, the problem with that is you have, Christ, how many rooms are on my floor? I think there were like 20 rooms. I think it was a couple of singles and there was mostly doubles. You probably had about 20, 25 guys on each floor. And it was technically a co-ed building, but the floors were still unisex. So you had a guy's floor, a gal's floor, a guy's floor, gal's floor. And on my floor, we had a very interesting group of people, but all of them were pretty much in the same mindset. We went to the zoo because we had all had watched Animal House, and we all wanted to enjoy keggers. So needless to say, we would get ourselves into shenanigans. It was absolute chaos. And no one could do anything about it because mommy and daddy were at home. So we're way out there. Mommy and daddy's over here. So we live the life of a college movie. But had mom and dad been there, none of us would engage in any shenanigans. In Russia, there was no mom and dad anymore. The Tsar was gone. Now the police state is gone. So in trying to give the people freedom, what ended up erupting was chaos. Because what does freedom mean? Well, freedom in my mind may mean that I have a right to have my house and I have a right to kind of do whatever I want, but I'm going to be a respectable member of the community. Whereas freedom in the mind of somebody else means, well, I'm going to basically get a baseball bat and I'm going to take whatever I want. And ultimately in Russia, all throughout the countryside, chaos started erupting. From the beginning of the revolution on our calendar, going all the way to November 1917, it was as if it was bad, badder, baddest on a daily basis. Germany, they continued to advance. Germany didn't quit the war just because there was a revolution. Nope, nope, nope. Which, of course, contributed to the political free-for-all. Peasants began seizing land. Food was hoarded. To say crime skyrocketed is an understatement. But to make matters worse, all of the national minorities began organizing and declaring themselves independent. The Russian Empire literally began crumbling. And in the face of all that, the provisional government made two mistakes. I've already told you the one. They ended the police state. Now, I've never seen any expert that said absolutely they could have saved things if the police state was retained. I've never said anyone that. But a lot of the experts that I've read said it might have held off what happened long enough for the war to come to an end. Don't know. Again, obviously, we can't go back and redo them all again. But in removing the police state, there was no mechanism to counter the second mistake. They decided to stay in the war. They misread the people. They believed that the riots were angry at the Tsar because of the way that the Tsar was conducting the war. In other words, the Tsar was an incompetent boob. So now that they're in charge, they're going to fight the war better. And when the war starts shifting and Russia starts winning, then the people are going to support the war again. And when they stay in until the victory, then their allies are going to give them stuff. Money, reparations, and the rest. And then they'll be able to cure the people. No. This isn't even like a swing and a miss. This was just like... the pitch comes, and you're standing at the plate for 7 days. And then suddenly you swing. That's how off it was. Oh, by the way, in the midst of this, Germany gave to Russia a little present. The leader of the Bolshevists, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, or as he's known by his revolutionary name, Lenin, with an I, it's not L-E-N-N-O-N, as in John, as in the Beatles. No, this is Lenin. Lenin would secretly arrive in St. Petersburg, Petrograd. Now, he was one of the Bolshevists that fled the police state. 1907 or 8, when he left Russia, he ended up in Germany. He was in the state of Munich, Bavaria rather, in the city of Munich. Ironically, in the same part of the city that Hitler would live in a few years later. But he got himself into a little bit of problem with the Germans, so he left Germany and was in Switzerland. Well, the Germans remembered that we had this Russian radical that they had basically shown the door. They remembered him, and they managed to contact him in Switzerland and would allow him to go back to the motherland. Amazingly, a train started in Switzerland, went into Germany, all the way through the Eastern Front, unstopped by the German military. Why? Oh, by the way, the Germans also gave him a huge wad of cash, too. And you know what he was paid to do? Go destabilize the provisional government. To go stir things up. To make it so that way the provisional government can't fix the problem. Well, when he arrived, he basically decided, I'm not just going to be a bomb thrower. We're going to go with a Marxist revolution. He proclaimed to the masses his plans to create a dictatorship of the proletariat. He would use the Soviet system, unify them to control the population. He would win support of the masses with promises of peace and land. And soon he would gather allies. The aforementioned Leon Trotsky, and of course, Joseph Stalin. And as the Bolshevists would go to work, the provisional government would completely come undone. They would lose absolute control over the situation. By the way, over the summer of 1917, over 2 million soldiers would desert. The Soviets took root in almost every major city, in the villages, and even in the rural towns. But the death blow for the provisional government came in a situation of their own making. In August 1917, in what is known as the Kurilov Affair, took place. Lev Kurilov was one of the few Russian generals that didn't lose. He didn't win, but he didn't lose. And as a reward, the provisional government would name him commander-in-chief of the Russian military. By this point, Prime Minister Kerensky would have a meeting with Kurilov, suggesting that the best way to beat the Soviets was to get the army on the side of the provisional government. So right now it's the workers and the soldiers. Well, you take the soldiers and you add them to the provisional government. But Kurilov apparently told Kerensky, I don't think we can get control of the soldiers that, for instance, are still in St. Petersburg. You know, they're gone. We're not going to get them back. Can't trust them. So, Kerensky begs and pleads. And then Kurilov, being a military man, basically lays it out on the line. Look, the only way we can seize control again is to completely seize control of the army. We got to stop all these mutinies. So give me the authority to reimpose the death penalty on site for any mutinies, which Kerensky said fine. Second, all of the soldiers who are known being involved in the Soviets, Kurilov wanted the names. They were going to be discharged dishonorably. and orders were going to be put in place where they would be shot on sight, which Kerensky did his best to comply with. Then, with that in place, Karnoloff went to some of the forces that were still on the front that still seemed to be loyal to him and repositioned them to have them march on Petrograd. They were going to be used to crush the Bolshevists and prevent them from taking over the Soviets. And here's where the problem began. Rumors started spreading that the general, like Caesar, marching at the head of loyal soldiers, loyal to him, was coming in to shoot the people, which would allow him to not reestablish the monarchy, no, but to implement a military dictatorship, to take away all of the rights that the provisional government just gave to them. As these rumors spread, absolute chaos erupted. And by the way, in the chaos, this is how the Bolshevists got into the Soviets. Because when everyone's going, ah, you don't see the people coming through the back door. Then an amazing thing happened. Kerensky apparently didn't tell the fellow members in the provisional government what was going on. So as the rumors caused chaos in the streets, the people in the provisional government are saying, my God, this guy's marching with an army and he's going to shoot us too? So unbeknownst to Kerensky, members of the provisional government began reaching out to the Soviets, asking for them to help stop this coup. So what do the Soviets do? They say, sure. They get, for example, the railroad unions to stop the trains. They get the utility workers to shut off the power, the gas, the water. Members of the provisional government also began going through the government arsenals and giving guns to the Soviets, so that way they can help defend the city from Karnoloff. The head of the government is the conspirator behind this idea, but the entire government undermines him. Well, if that was not enough, and I know I'm almost out of time, I'm just going to finish this. If that was not enough, even the loyal men to Karnoloff basically say, yeah, wait, what? We're going to go and we're going to go into the capital and we're going to shoot our fellow citizens? Yeah, that's not happening. And when this occurs, Karnoloff realizes he has no support. His own soldiers place him under arrest. They turn him over to the provisional government and he's imprisoned. And he's charged with attempting a coup. Now, ironically, timing would save his life. He never had a trial. But he was going to be found guilty of treason. And he was going to be shot. But in the chaos, and I got one more click, in the chaos that we're going to talk about at the beginning of next class would erupt, he managed to sneak out of St. Petrograd. Petrograd, not St. Petersburg. He ended up going south, and he would become one of the leaders of the anti-Bolshevik army, the White Army, during the Civil War. But the poor bastard died when he was hit. Not sure where in his body he was hit, but he actually physically was hit directly by an artillery shell. And his body just went whoosh. But this is where I'll click. Needless to say, when this occurred, the provisional government lost all credibility. Because what do you think Kerensky did when he found out that the provisional government gave the Soviets guns? It's like, dude, this was my idea. But in the end, the people didn't care. and they decided to go with land in peace.
All right, we'll end it there. Well, I got a little bit left of the Russian Revolution, but I got a little chatty. I like explaining things. So we're going to talk about the rise of the Bolsheviks, Russia coming out of the war, and then we're going to see what was going on in the Western Front in 1917. Hasta la vista. See you Thursday. You were going to ask a question.